Hi, everyone, and welcome to What's in Your Hometown? We're back!
I'm so freaking excited.
Me too. I'm Sam, sitting 1,000 miles away. Well, not 1,000, more than 1,000 miles away from me is Jules.
Hey.
Hey.
So this is What's in Your Hometown, and we're a podcast that talks about the dirty little shit in your backyard. Thank you a million times for joining us.
Uh-huh, a million bajillion.
Yeah. So we've been on hiatus for about a month.
But it seems like forever.
It really does seem like forever. It feels like it's been way longer than a month.
Way
and
longer.
And so much has happened.
Everything has happened.
Right. So, quick recap.
Yes, yes.
First and foremost, most importantly, we graduated law school.
Oh, thank God.
We are done. We are officially full swing into prepping for the bar exam now, which is its own special kind of hell.
It's almost worse than school because it's like, here, learn all these topics you definitely forgot from year one. And 30 days? Good luck.
Exactly. But, like, we're back. It's fine. But we graduated, and I'm super proud of us. I'm so proud of you for everything that you did.
I'm so proud of you for everything that you did.
Thank you. We had an awesome graduation party. It rained the entire time.
Yeah, and but then I got stuck in the mud.
I finally got to meet your mom. Like, I got to meet your family. I'm so happy.
Yeah, I got to meet my mom and my family.
And then, not 3 days later, you left me.
Yeah, so my whole schedule was, all right, you've graduated. Get the hell out of West Virginia as quick as you can. So, graduated the 10th, left the 12th, drove 5 days across country, and got to Vegas the 16th.
And now you're all settled in and job searching and...
Oh, yes, job searching.
I know. Girl, I'm sorry. But it's fine. You haven't been at it that long, and you've encountered so many scams.
Oh, my God. Listen. That's what's in my backyard this week. Listen, I encounter a scam a day. Like, somebody sending me a message, and it's like, hey, we've reviewed your application. Would you like to have an interview? It's not even like, here's a job. It's like, would you like to have an interview with our company? And I'm like, abso-fucking-lutely, I would. And then I go to have, like, I start looking into it. Because I've applied to so many jobs, I just don't remember where I've applied to. So I don't think, oh, I've never applied to this company. So I start looking into it, and then it's like, oh, this doesn't exist. I'm like, God damn it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you'll find a real one. I have all the confidence in the world for you that you really will find a job.
Thank you. And if none of that works out, I guess I could take that Singapore job that they offered me
yesterday. Oh, totally. You could go live in Singapore. That would be fun.
Yeah.
Sort of.
I already stay in my apartment all day and don't talk to anybody. A language barrier is just what I need.
Right. But I guess our biggest news, aside from graduating and moving, we have been picked up by the Civilized Creatures Entertainment Network.
Yep, yep.
Holy shit, y'all. I'm so excited.
Me too. I was like nodding because I have like we're on Skype right now and I was like nodding. Julia can see me. None of you can hear me nod. It's the problem.
It's okay. But no, we're on the network. We're the first true crime podcast on their network. There are so many amazing shows, and there are so many amazing people that are involved.
We've met a lot of the people on the podcast network, and they're all so nice. And it was so good just to be able to talk to somebody who does what we do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I've talked to them a little bit more than you have just because of scheduling conflicts.
Yeah.
But some of the other podcasts on our network they're all really, really good. They're quality content.
Mm-hmm.
Married AF with Brooke and Randall Fowler. They're so funny and they give great advice and they're wonderful, huge personalities. Follow them on Twitter, if nothing else, because they will make you laugh at least once a day.
Oh, yeah.
Also, Drinks with Larry. They're wonderful. We're hoping to be guests on their show pretty soon.
Yeah.
And Larry professionally is a stand-up comedian, so the whole thing is just absolutely a riot. There's the Unbelievably Stupid podcast, and John from there
which speaks to my soul.
Oh yeah. Like, right? If you ever like scroll through your newsfeed and you're like, what the fuck is happening right now? That's the podcast that you want to listen to.
Yep.
And John from that network has been so good to us. He's helping us out with our sound.
Yes.
And he's like a guru. He's got a bunch of other podcasts too, so check him out for sure. And the other two people I think that are involved with that. Personal favorite of mine is 8-Bit Closed Fist, which is like nerd culture.
Yep.
They do video games, they do superheroes, they do geeky things, they do movies. Like, they're really good people, and I'm hoping to be a guest on their show if I don't make an absolute idiot out of myself. But other people on the network are Pub Shenanigans, who are just like good down-home Southern boys out to have a good time and drink. They're fun. The Bearded Dad podcast. He doesn't have a lot on Spotify, so I haven't listened to a lot of his. But the stuff that I have seen is hilarious. And his voice is, like, really soothing. That's a weird thing to say, but it is.
No, I understand that completely, yeah.
Yeah, and he talks about some really important stuff, too. So, like, check him out. And then finally is Conversation X. And their tagline is Gen Xers who get together and discuss how the 90s shaped their 40s.
Oh my God. The 90s have shaped my whole life.
Right? We're 90s babies.
We are so. 90s babies. I miss the 90s, and not just because my whole life centered around eating and juice. Like.
Yeah. So they're really great. I just listened to their newest episode. And their kid went on a cruise and racked up an outrageous cell phone bill. Someone was capable of texting that much.
Oh, no.
So go check them out. But yeah, no, that's our network. That's our little family now. And yep, we're so...
we have a family.
We do. Somebody likes us.
What is it from Lilo and Stitch? Ohana means family. We have an Ohana.
Do. But anyway, that's our collective backyards. I know that this ran over like our 5 minutes that we try to keep it, but it's been a month since we've checked in with y'all. So
yeah, it's been quite a while since we've checked in with each other too. Like, we text when we Facebook message back and forth every day, but we don't usually like see each other. And so to like see each other face to face, we have like a whole bunch of shit that's just like we want to talk about. We're going to try and keep it low, but.
Yeah, so prepare for some bullshittery.
Yep.
So anyway, this is going to be a true crime episode. And I know, three in a row, we're going to get back to urban legends next week. I promise. And we're going to have ones for you.
Sam!
What?
Figure your shit out. I keep nodding at you. Like, everybody else can hear me nod.
I feel like this so far has just been me word vomiting at you.
No. I feel like if I ever start nodding, you just need to give like subtitles. Sam's nodding.
But anyway, I've been talking for a while. Do you want to go first?
No. Let's rock paper scissors it, because if we start doing you go first, I go first, we're gonna lose track. So let's just do random.
Oh no, we will.
As always. Are you ready?
Yep.
Rock paper scissors shoot.
Both scissors. Rock.
Paper, scissors, shoot. Oh, did you do... Oh,
I'm rock.
Okay, I'm paper, so I'll go first.
Okay.
There's a delay, so I keep thinking that you can just see what I do first.
Okay.
Alrighty. So, I, as Julia brought up, have been applying to quite a lot of jobs, and I've been scammed. Well, not scammed. I have been scammed quite a lot of times. I haven't fallen for the scam. So it's just like preemie scam. Like, here's a scam. Do you want to fall for it? And I'm like, nah, thank you though. So in light of all that, I decided to shape my murder around my experience. Now, I'm not going to tell you anything about the murder. I'm just going to jump into it because I want it to be like a surprise.
I'm so excited. You've sort of given me like teasers about how you've written up your notes for this, and like, I'm along for the ride. This is going to be so good.
Yeah. Now that I don't have to be in school for 24 hours a day, I have more time to write these notes. So I've tried to structure them way better than what I have been structuring my notes. So we're just going to jump into it. In November of 2011, Scott Davis, a 48-year-old divorcee, stumbled upon a help wanted ad posted on Craigslist. This is what the ad said. It said, "Wanted. Caretaker for farm. Simply watch over a 688-acre patch of hilly farmland and feed a few cows." When I first read this, I was like, how do you simply watch over a 688-acre of hilly farmland? I was like, that's not a simple job. You don't just like wake up in the morning, grab a cup of coffee, go stand on your porch and go, yep, it's still there, and go back in. You have to make the rounds.
All right.
So you get $300 a week and a nice 2-bedroom trailer. Someone older and single preferred, but we'll consider all. Relocation is a must. You must have a clean record and be trustworthy, as this is a permanent position. The farm is used mainly as a hunting preserve, is overrun with game, has a stocked 3-acre pond, but some beef cattle will be kept. Nearest neighbor is a mile away. The place is secluded and beautiful. It will be a real getaway for the right person, job of a lifetime. If you are ready to relocate, please contact Position Will Not Stay Open.
Like, I can see why that would be super appealing to a lot of people, mm-hmm. but also, I know that this is a murder episode.
Also, I think if anything describes, like, the job as job of a lifetime, it's gonna be the end of your lifetime. It's not a real thing. All right, so Scott... Remember Scott from the first sentence that took me 4 tries to say. Scott, who was looking for a job near his ailing mother in Ohio, viewed this ad as a godsend. He immediately replied to the posting, but didn't hear back for a couple weeks. It was about a month. So he replied in October when he first found the posting, and the person who posted it didn't get back to him until November. It was a couple weeks, about a month. When he did hear back, he was told that he was going to be given the position. He was told that the farmhouse was furnished, and if he had any electronics to bring them and any vehicles to bring them. So it was going to be furnished. He didn't have to buy furniture, but if he had electronics or vehicles, go ahead and bring them. They're not at this farmhouse.
Okay, cool.
So Scott immediately packed everything and drove to Akron, Ohio.
Akron.
Oh, well, here's the thing. I'm not sure that's exactly where he went either. I couldn't figure it out. It's either Marietta or Akron. And most everything happens in Akron. So I think all this took place in Akron.
Okay, fair. Marietta has some shady shit going on, but.
Yeah. Well, he met. Okay, we'll get to it.
Okay.
Scott ended up meeting Richard, or as his friends called him, Jack Beasley, the man who had posted the ad, and his nephew, 16-year-old Brogan Rafferty, at a Shoney's in Marietta, Ohio. So either the farm was in Akron and they met in Marietta and then drove to the farm, or the farm was in Marietta and that's like, because Beasley lived in Akron and he drove up to Marietta to meet this dude. So... where was I? Okay, so they met at a Shoney's in Marietta, Ohio, where they ate breakfast, and Beasley told him more about the farm and asked Scott questions about himself and what he had brought with him, explaining that due to damage on the road leading to the secluded farmland that he would be caring for, Scott would have to leave the truck and trailer that he had packed all of his things in the parking lot of Shoney's. And once the road was repaired, it could all be collected and moved out to this farmland, which... I mean, I see your face. It does. That's a little sketchy, but also sort of makes sense. Like, I've lived in one of those, like, backroads farms where it's, like, this winding road forever. Like, winding gravel road. It's not even paved.
I get it. I'm not at all disputing that, you know, it's totally plausible that the road has washed out. Let me leave my shit someplace nicer than a Shoney's.
That's true. Okay, I see where you're coming from now. Yeah, I agree with that. Anyway, Scott readily agreed and climbed in the back of Beasley's truck as Brogan, who remember was the nephew, drove Beasley and Scott to the farm. The crew drove for about half an hour, give or take. The trees were becoming thicker and the road slipped into nothing more than a winding path before Beasley turned to his nephew and asked if Brogan would drop them off near where, quote, we got that deer last time. So they hadn't reached the farm. They were stopping somewhere else. He turned and explained to Scott that he had left a piece of equipment in a or near a nearby creek and asked if Scott would mind retrieving it with him. He explained that he needed this equipment to help them get through the part of the road that was damaged. I know. Sketchy as hell. All right. So Scott agreed.
What the fuck was that my favorite murder thing? Stay out of the forest.
Right? Exactly. Stay out of the forest. Don't. If anybody is like, hey, you want to go into the woods with me? Go, no. Nothing good happens in the woods.
Plenty of good things can happen in the woods. Not with strangers.
Not with strangers. No, no. But Scott agreed, and the three of them, so it was Beasley, Brogan, and Scott, disembarked into the woods looking for whatever it was that Beasley needed. It wasn't until Scott heard the click that he realized he was in trouble. Even then, it wasn't until he heard the words fuck slip from Beasley's mouth and turned around to see Beasley unjamming the pistol he held at Scott, did Scott realize how much trouble he was in.
Ooh. Okay. Yeah. Plot twist.
So Beasley unjammed the pistol, raised his arm, aimed at Scott, and pulled the trigger without hesitation. Scott threw his arms up over his head, which caused the bullet to enter into his elbow instead of his head. And saved his life. Yeah.
Yeah.
Acting on adrenaline, Scott then turned and raced away from Beasley, trying desperately to get out of range of the bullets that were still being fired at him. So he was, like, outrunning. They were still firing at him.
Oh, shit.
Zigzagging. Which is what Rickon should have done the entire scene in Battle of the Bastards. Zigzagging.
You are still mad about that. Goddamn. Still it's mad been a about while.
Rickon! Okay. I'm still mad about a lot about Game of Thrones, but we don't need to go in that. So Scott ran for a while before he dropped and buried himself into a creek bed. So, like, it was like an overhang of the creek bed. The creek bed had dried up a little bit, so he could, like, push himself into the overhang so nobody would be able to see him. And he buried himself in there and waited. Now, remember, it's November. He's cold and bleeding to death and terrified. He realized if he didn't move, he was going to bleed out. He was going to die. So Scott waited until dark, crawled out from under the creek bed, and walked 7 miles until he found a farmhouse.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wait, is the trailer that was advertised real?
The actual farm?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Okay, because I would be so pissed if he walked for 7 miles and then showed up at the guy's house that just tried to kill him.
Okay. Yeah, I'd be pretty mad about that, too.
All right, please continue with your story. I just needed that little bit of closure.
No. Upon seeing him, the landowners immediately called 911 and rescue soon arrived. The problem was the police didn't believe his story at all.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
They said, to his face, I would like to add, that he was a dope dealer and that this was a deal gone wrong. And Scott was like, Scott, who was still bleeding, went, no, not a dope dealer. I was definitely shot by a guy who put up a Craigslist ad. And he had proof. He told the police, if you'll go look at my truck. And so they found the truck at the Shoney's. It had been left alone. And then they found emails that he had printed out from between him and Beasley. So he had proof, and it was then that the cops were like, oh shit, somebody's like a murderer is out there. Somebody who tried to murder you is out on the run.
Okay, good job, police.
So Scott survived. There's the silver lining in this whole story.
Oh, good.
Scott survived. He's doing well. Police quickly called the FBI to get help determining the origin of the Craigslist ad. In the meantime, investigators sent officers and a cadaver dog back to the scene of Scott's shooting. There, they unearthed a body buried face down in a shallow grave along with several personal items. They also discovered a second grave, but this grave was empty and police theorized it was meant for Scott.
Okay. See, when you said where we got that deer last time, I immediately went, oh, that wasn't a deer. But then I didn't want to ruin the rest of the story.
Yeah, no, you were right.
Okay.
So the news immediately picked up the story. And a few days later, police received a call from a woman claiming her twin brother had answered a similar Craigslist ad and hadn't been heard from since.
Ooh.
So David Pauly was a 51-year-old divorcee living with his brother when he found the Craigslist ad. He immediately replied and was pretty quickly offered the job. Before he left for Ohio, he called his sister Debbie to tell her about the job and how he would be living closer to her because she lived in Ohio. His brother was in Virginia.
Okay.
Debbie later identified Paul as the body police had found in the woods.
Oh, honey.
Yeah.
That's so hard.
So, using the information Scott had given them, police soon acquired video footage from the Shoneys that Scott had eaten at with Beasley and Brogan. The FBI also managed to trace the IP address of where the Craigslist ad had originated. When SWAT rolled up to the address, they were met not with Beasley, but with Joe Bias. I think it's Bias. It's B-I-A-S, and I don't know how to say that other than Bias.
Well, it's either Bias or Bias, depending on where you're from, but...
Yeah. But they were met with Joe Bias, who was the landlord, and assured them that no one by the name of Jack or Richard Beasley had ever lived in the building.
Okay.
However, upon being shown a photo of Beasley, the man admitted to having rented a room to the man in the photo, but insisted that his name was not Richard Beasley, but was instead Ralph Greiger.
Okay.
And he hadn't seen him for several days.
Mm. Well, I mean, the smart thing to do after you fail to kill someone is skip town.
Yeah.
I wasn't really expecting smart anything from this story, so.
Once police were inside the apartment, they found several pieces of identification, all bearing the name Ralph Greiger. Or Greiger. Greiger. I'm going to go with Greiger. It's wrong. But at the same time, officers were looking for and found Richard Beasley and Brogan Rafferty. He did not skip town.
Oh.
No. They found them. Beasley immediately lawyered up, but Brogan, a 16-year-old faced with murder charges, sang like a canary. I mean, he immediately was like, I'll tell you everything if you cut me a deal.
Oh, teenagers.
So before I tell you any more about what happened, I'm going to tell you a little bit about Richard Beasley.
Okay.
Or the so-called Richard Beasley. So Richard Jack Beasley was born in Akron, Ohio, and grew up in a pretty rough household. His father was an alcoholic, and he was verbally and physically abusive.
That sucks.
Yeah, pretty rough household. So in 1970, after graduating from high school, Beasley moved to Texas. However, he didn't flourish there. Unable to find a steady job, he turned to crime, and in 1985 was brought up on 6 counts of burglary and ended up doing 5 years.
Oof, okay.
When he was released, he returned to Ohio intent on getting his life together. In 1992, he met his wife, and a few months after their marriage, became a father to a little girl named Tanya.
Oh, okay.
But Beasley wasn't able to outrun his past. I suspect
I'm concerned for that child.
No, he, the first... Because I got a lot of this information on Monsters in the Family, like the TV show Monsters in the Family.
Yeah.
Where it's like family members of killers talk about their relationship with that killer. And like for her, it was her dad. And it seemed like the first few years of her life, he was actually really good. He was like a really good dad.
Oh, good. Okay. And then?
And then... despite telling his family that he was working for a friend in their factory, he had actually turned back to burglarizing homes and dealing weapons in order to put food on the table.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's a tough situation, and I feel bad judging him for it. I do.
Yeah, it is a tough situation, especially because it's so hard for people who have a record to find a steady job.
Mm-hmm.
In 1966... he was arrested and sentenced to 7 years in federal prison.
Oof.
Mm-hmm. His wife divorced him, and he slowly lost touch with his daughter, despite the fact that she had court-mandated visits. She had to go visit him.
Oh, man, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
However, while in prison, like many inmates, Beasley found God. He started studying the Bible and memorizing verses. When he got out of prison, he was determined to turn his life around, and he did. He quickly became a chaplain for a local ministry and, I wrote this in my notes, pun intended, religiously attended church.
Okay.
Was that towards the pun or the church?
That was the pun.
That's justified. Yeah. He was hit among children because by this time he had white hair and a big bushy white beard. So he looked like Santa Claus.
Okay. And
he loved children too. He was always there. He always tried to make time to spend with them. And he started his relationship with his daughter anew. So he really turned his life around.
Good for him. I got lost on this storyline thing. Okay. So is Richard Beasley a separate person, or is he the one that just went and killed somebody or tried to?
You have to go on this journey with me.
Okay, I'm sorry.
The point is to be confused. Is he? Isn't he? Come on this yellow brick road with me.
That's fair. People are complicated. They have complex lives and interests, and good people can do bad things, and bad people can do good things.
Exactly.
And,
so, at this point in the story, it's up to you guys. Is he really Richard Grieger, or is he really Ralph Grieger, or is he Richard Beasley? Is Richard Beasley just another victim?
All right.
So he started a relationship with his daughter anew. In fact, they would go to the local soup kitchen every Friday, and if the meals weren't sponsored, Beasley would buy the food himself.
Well, that was really nice of him.
Mm-hmm. He even found a new job in a factory and started a crime-free life. Sadly, soon after being released from prison and starting his life over, he was in a bad car accident and suffered pretty bad back injuries.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah. Still, he persevered and took the settlement he won for those back injuries to open up a halfway house for drug addicts, prostitutes, and wayward kids.
Okay, so, like, he's doing really good things with his life.
Mm-hmm.
And you've confused me, and now I'm hesitant.
What do you think? What's your theory?
I think I've seen enough people with really bad back injuries around this area of the country fall into terrible drug addiction.
Yeah, so here's the problem.
Okay.
Because of the back injuries, he can no longer work in the factory, so he turned to selling drugs and pimping out the prostitutes, seeking refuge in his halfway house.
Yeah, I thought so. Okay, yeah. Cool. That's where this is going.
He would continue their drug addiction, providing the drugs and making them completely reliant on him. So at first, the halfway house, he didn't accept girls. It was only boys, which I can understand because it's sort of like a dorm situation. You want to separate.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. A lot of the more successful halfway houses, at least around here, are, you know, women only or men only.
Yeah.
Because you have a whole different experience with people who are the same gender as you than you do having all of that. And then, I mean, assuming the people there are straight, taking sex out of the equation and sexual attraction out of the equation really does help a lot of people.
Yeah. So he started with a men's only halfway house, and then after his accident included women so that he could flip it and prostitute them out.
Nah.
Yeah.
This was nice for a little while.
He even went as far as getting his daughter's boyfriend addicted and having him sell drugs on Beasley's behalf.
What?
Yeah.
That's so shitty.
Yeah.
Because you should see Jeff's face right now. He is not impressed.
Because in, like, the Monsters in the Family episode, it's his daughter telling the story. Mm-hmm. So, no one knew. He successfully kept this a secret. Like, his daughter this whole time thought, like, she knew he was struggling with an addiction to his pain pills. She didn't realize that he had gotten back into selling and was prostituting people. So no one knew. Everyone saw him as, like, a self-proclaimed street preacher that was helping kids. He would even go to, like, court and, like, tell the judge, plead with the judge, hey, they've made a mistake. I have a halfway house. If you'll just send them to the halfway house, I can help them get the help that they need. And judges fell for it. They sent these kids to him.
Oh God. I am, like, deep down in my soul disgusted with this person.
I know.
I don't want to be disgusted with someone who feeds homeless people, Sam.
Exactly. So, I understand completely. Here's the answer to your earlier question. No one knew what he was doing. His daughter knew that he was addicted to pain pills, but they didn't know what was going on. In 2011, some of the women from the halfway house came forward to the police, and he was formally charged with multiple drug offenses. I assume he was also charged for trying to prostitute them out, but I didn't find that.
Mm-hmm.
Authorities in Texas, where he first went to jail, got wind of this arrest and issued a parole violation, making him a wanted man in Texas.
Ooh.
Completely unwilling to go back to prison, Beasley took his new mentee, the son of a family friend he had met at church, Brogan Rafferty, and started the hunt for a new identity.
Oh, shit.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wait. Was the guy, like, he just took IDs off the bodies he killed, or?
Nope.
No? Okay.
Here's what happened.
Sorry, I'm, like, jumping to conclusions.
No, I love it. I love it when you guess.
Okay.
That means I wrote this correctly.
Okay, good. Yeah, no, you wrote it correctly. You're absolutely right.
So Brogan had come to look at Beasley as not just a mentor, but a father figure. He was very easily coerced, and he was eager to please. So they went on the hunt for someone who looked like Beasley. What they found was Ralph Greiger, a homeless man seeking refuge at a nearby shelter.
Oh, Beasley, my God.
Yep.
My whole jaw just dropped. My jaw actually dropped. I cannot begin to imagine the horrible things you're about to say.
Oh, see, now I feel less excited about my excitement because I was like, ah, I tricked you.
No.
Okay, so Beasley approached the man and offered him a job tending to a 680-acre farm. Greiger eagerly accepted. Beasley drove him and Brogan out to the farm. When they arrived, Beasley led Greiger and Brogan into a thickly wooded area, and as Brogan tells it, he looked up to see Beasley take a pistol out from where he had hidden it and shoot Greiger in the back of the head.
Oh my God, they're taking a fucking book out of the Copelands. Mm-hmm. What?
Yep, yep.
Okay.
Beasley then had Brogan bury the body because he had back problems. He couldn't bury the body. So he had Brogan bury the body.
Okay.
In
yeah.
a shallow grave and drove back to Akron. Back home,
okay.
Beasley dyed his hair and changed his clothes to look more like Greiger, got a new apartment under Greiger's name. And in the meantime, Beasley went to his daughter asking for help to put up a Craigslist ad for a friend who was seeking a caretaker for his farm.
Okay.
No, I will say she had no idea what was happening because she wrote the Craigslist ad. She had no idea what he was asking from her. She really thought that she was writing an ad for a farm, a caretaker position on a farm.
No, I believe that.
Oh, yeah. She, like, in the episode, she feels horrible guilt because she's the one that wrote the Craigslist ad.
Well, how would you not feel guilty about that? Like, exactly. Obviously you didn't know. I assume her dad didn't come to her and go, hey, I need a Craigslist ad for a murder farm. Do you mind trying to lure people to their deaths for me?
I know we have had a rocky relationship, but I think it's time to get you into the family business.
Point for you.
All right. All right. So the fake farm attracted dozens of applicants, but Beasley was looking for someone specific. He wanted someone with money or goods to sell, someone who no one would miss, like Greiger. And he wanted specifically somebody in his 40s with really no family. Mm. So he started to narrow down his list. The first man to be offered the job was David Pauley. Beasley took David into the woods, shot him, and then had Brogan bury the body. The second man to be offered the job was Scott Davis. We know what happened to him.
Right.
The third man to be offered the job was Timothy Kern.
There was more?
There's more.
What?
I know. I spent so long trying to write this in just the right way, and I'm so glad it's paid off.
Wait, I'm so confused. There was more?
Yeah. Okay. So he tried to shoot and kill Scott, and Scott got free. And after Scott escaped, Beasley realized that he needed cash quick so that he could escape the area. So he accepted Timothy Kern's offer.
What?
Mm-hmm. This whole time, keep in mind, this whole time, the story about him and Kern, the police are currently looking for Beasley.
Yeah.
So Kern was a 47-year-old father of three. Even though he was divorced, he was a large part of his children's life. He worked as a DJ at a local club but had recently been fired. And he was desperate to provide for his children. So Kern saw this job, like Scott did, as a godsend. Because he didn't have a working car, his son Nick drove him to meet Beasley. Kern then left with Beasley and Brogan, believing they were taking him to his new job.
Oh my God, what?
Mm-hmm. Instead, knowing he couldn't bring Kern to the site of the other murders, Beasley drove Kern to a wooded area behind an abandoned mall and asked him, or he was asking him along the way, like what kinds of things he brought with him. The same deal with Scott. What did you bring with you? Just small talk type of things, but he was trying to figure out what he could sell. Here's the problem. It was then that Beasley learned that Kern had nothing more than $5 to his name and a bag full of clothes.
Oh.
Yeah. So Beasley parked behind the mall and told Kern, I lost my watch here the other day, and asked Kern if he wouldn't mind helping him look for it. Kern agreed, got out of the car, faced away from Beasley, and Beasley pulled a gun and shot him in the back of the head.
What the fuck? What the fuck? Yep, yep. No. Yep, yep, yep. No. Oh my God. You just had someone's son drive them to their death, and then when you figured out that, like, oh no, I actually can't use this guy for anything, you fucking killed him anyway?
Yep.
I am shook.
Yes.
I shouldn't say that, because it just...
You're shooketh.
It doesn't feel right, but, like, to my core.
Oh, yeah. Oh, what? Yeah. No, he was just a monster. He was a monster.
Ugh.
So Brogan once again buried the body in a shallow grave. Officers at this time had found Beasley's apartment and all the documents containing Grieger's name. Beasley's landlord gave officers Beasley's phone number, which they used to track him down. Brogan cut a deal and testified against Beasley. He has a life sentence. Beasley, who denied everything on stand, was found guilty and sentenced to death.
All right, fine.
He appealed, but the Ohio Supreme Court voted 6-1 that the death sentence was appropriate.
Yeah. Because, yeah.
Yeah. And then, in this Monsters in the Family, Tanya, Beasley's daughter, and Nick, Kern's son, actually met. And it was sort of like a closing situation for the both of them, because Nick, Kern's son, told her, hey, I don't blame you for writing this ad. You had no idea what was going to happen. And she was like, I'm really sorry about what my dad did to you. I know that he's more than just a headline, and I'm so sorry that you've lost somebody like that. So it was like a closing situation for both of them, and it was really sweet. So I got the information from Monsters in the Family. I think it's either Monsters Among Us or Monsters in the Family. And then I got the rest of the information from wickedwee.com. The article is called This Craigslist Killer Gets Three Death Sentences by Maxwell Charles.
Okay.
And that's my story. So I don't have a job, but I'm not dead.
Fuck, man. All right, cool. If you go to try and work on a farm, I will stop you.
I hope you would stop me.
I'll stop you for a couple different reasons before I think you're going to be murdered. Partly because I don't think that you're going to be great at farm work.
No, because my whole method would be to, like, go, like, walk out of the trailer, look around, go, everything seems fine, and then go back in the house.
Yeah. No. It's not great. But no, holy shit, man. Okay, you wanted twists and turns and suspense and, like, all that. You got it. Thank you.
Oh, I'm so glad that creative writing degree is finally being put to use.
Okay. Well, mine isn't as twisty-turny.
Okay.
Even close. I honestly think it's a little bit boring compared to yours. But we...
Yours are never boring.
I hope this one isn't boring, because it's fucked up. I had Jeff read over my notes before I sat down to, like, try and figure out our sound. And he looked at me and went, what the fuck is this?
I'm so excited.
So, great. All right, here we are. We are going on a little trip to a peaceful, tranquil, really chill little ski resort town in Maine. And
I feel so tricked already. I'm like, oh, so peaceful. And then I know the next thing out of your mouth is going to be like, and then people were brutally murdered.
It's not the next thing. So we are going to a little town called Newry, Maine. N-E-W-R-Y. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that, but I don't know how to say it other than Newry. Okay, so, like, just to give you a little bit of a lay of the land for where we are. Like, it's a little ski town on the western border of Maine, close to New Hampshire. And it has a population of 329 people in 2010.
Oh my god.
It is little. It's about 75 miles northwest of Portland, and it's a super popular skiing region. So basically the town is a collection of inns and like beds and breakfasts. And its genuine claim to fame, the only thing that it's really notable for other than this murder, is that in 1960 was the site of one of Maine's worst Cold War aircraft disasters. Which,
okay,
you fucking know I looked up.
Absolutely. You love aircraft disasters.
I love air disasters to a point that, like, y'all maybe should be concerned. But
she loves air disasters to a point, like, did y'all know that there's a show about air disasters? Because I didn't know that was a thing until I went to her house.
I've seen, like, all 8 seasons. It's so good. Anyway, I will spare you all of the details, but if you're curious, please feel free to reach out. I will talk to you about this.
Absolutely. Absolutely, she will. She will hold full conversations with you about how air disasters fascinate her.
All right, so murder. Away from air disasters. Murder.
That's another podcast.
It really is. I'm going to introduce you to our lovely cast of characters.
Okay.
You have a mother and daughter named Julie Bullard, and her daughter is Selby Bullard.
Oh, I like the name Selby.
I do too. It's really cute.
Yeah.
Julie is in her 60s. She ran an inn in the San Francisco Bay Area before she moved to Maine. And she moved about 3 years, 2 or 3 years before this all happened with her daughter Selby. The reason that they wanted to go and start a new life as far away from San Francisco as they possibly could is honestly really tragic. Selby is the mother of 2 young children, and her husband was killed in a car accident. So they're just trying as hard as they can to, like, get away,
to start a new life,
like, figure it out. And I can't really imagine a scenario that's more different from San Francisco than, like, Maine ski resort.
Yeah, that's a whole different environment.
It really is.
Like here, like from West Virginia to Las Vegas, it's a whole different
environment. It's very different. Yeah.
I heard that. What was that? Was that the demon possessing you trying to come out?
I think it was. I had no control over that, I swear.
He was like, I'm in pain all the time. I got the wrong body.
I keep trying to offer him mints, and he just won't accept them. But anyway, Julie, you know, she ran sort of like a bed and breakfast around San Francisco, and she figured that's what she's good at, that's what she can do. So she goes and decides to run a place called the Black Bear Inn, which is a super cute, like, 7-bedroom bed and breakfast. It was built in the 1830s. Yeah. And Selby, in order to support her kids, worked a couple of different odd jobs. Like, she ran an eyeglasses store for a while, and she did nails until she worked her way up to getting a real estate license. And
oh, nice.
Yeah, no, like, it's a really cool, like, self-made story. She started working for Apple Tree Realty in nearby Bethel.
Okay.
So Julie ran the Black Bear for about 3 years, but she, you know, she started to get restless. She wanted a new adventure. She was 65. It was doing okay. Like, it's not super easy to make a living running a bed and breakfast, but, you know, she had experience. She was good at it. It was in a pretty popular area. But she decided that she wanted to move to New York City.
Yeah.
So in the spring of 2006, she put the Black Bear Inn up for sale and continued to run it while it was on the market.
Mm-hmm.
there wasn't a whole lot of interest in running it, so she ended up keeping it for a while. And while she was trying to run it, she still needed staff. Like, she still needed cooks and handymen and all that. So she ended up hiring, around June, a new cook named Christian Nielsen.
Okay.
Nielsen, by all accounts, is described as a reliable employee and a good cook and a soft-spoken, quiet guy.
Okay, so the last episode that, because I drove across country, so I drove with my mom, so I played like our podcast so she could hear us a little bit. The last episode that I listened to was the ship captain, the Mary Russell, who was described as a great captain and totally reliable. And I feel like we're about to go down the same road.
Yep. Yep. Okay. But like, the most serious offense on his record up to the point of this story was one DUI. And he had, like, he'd gone to college for a couple of semesters for an English degree, and it hadn't worked out for him, so he dropped out. But, like,
you know us English degrees turn to murder on a snap of, no like, kidding. A snap of a finger.
There are troves of articles about how everybody was super shocked and, like, he was a good guy and, like, it honestly, reading it, how, like, you know, he was just sort of quiet sometimes, but, like, he really liked comic books and he had a good sense of humor. He was just a little closed off. Like, fuck all of you who read those articles.
It sounds like a serial killer.
He is.
He was just really closed off. Oh, no. I fit that description. I just stay in my house all day. I like comic books. Julia, no. I have something
well,
to tell
I mean,
you.
I thought we were going to get to this point eventually. I'm glad you finally decided to tell me about it.
Yeah, sorry. I moved across country because of the bodies. I just couldn't be in West Virginia anymore.
Bitch, there was a reason I never looked in your basement.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't because it was haunted with rats.
Like, it wasn't. Oh, God. There's so many rats. No, but you're right. It was bodies. It was definitely bodies.
Okay, so Nielsen, honestly, is the truest image that I can think up in my head of a cold-blooded, remorseless killer.
Ooh.
He's like Manson and Bundy, but without any of the charisma.
Oh, poor Nielsen.
Right?
He got the short end of the stick there.
Totally did. Like, I say a lot, like, jail, I have this whole thing about mass incarceration. I'm so pissed off about people putting people in jail for drugs. Jail is supposed to be for people that we're afraid of and not for people that we're mad at.
Yeah, exactly. I'm there with
you. He's someone we're afraid of.
Yeah.
He should be in prison forever.
Okay. I'll agree with you before hearing this, but I definitely am on the same page as you.
Okay. Anyway, things, for the most part, things were fine. There wasn't any, like, trouble stirring. There weren't any conflicts that were reported, at least. Over the summer of that year, Julie Bullard offered a man named James Whitehurst a free room at the inn in exchange for his services as a handyman.
Aw.
Because she was trying to fix it up and sell it.
Mm-hmm.
So she figured, hey, I'll go ahead and give you a room if you'll fix it. And he was about 50 years old from Batesville, Arkansas.
All I'm seeing right now concerning this inn is Forrest Gump. Have you seen the movie Forrest Gump?
I have seen Forrest Gump.
Yeah, because
I promise you. It's, no, you're right. It's like if, like Forrest Gump, but if Bubba Gump just fucking murdered everybody.
Oh, okay. Okay, then.
So, things were fine. She hired this handyman and gave him, in exchange for, instead of paying him, she just let him live there.
Mm-hmm.
Things were fine. Nothing wrong. Cool. From June through September. Then on Friday, September 1st, 2006, the beginning of the Labor Day weekend, for no apparent reason, Nielsen shot and killed Whitehurst.
Okay.
The details of all of these murders are a little bit scarce because there were no witnesses. The forensic evidence lined up pretty well with Nielsen's story, and he apparently is not one to brag.
Okay.
So, basically, there wasn't, like, I'll get into motive later, because it's real fucked up.
Yeah.
But, basically, September 1st, it's a Friday, he shoots and kills Whitehurst, and then takes the body 15 miles away to a town called Upton, where he dismembers him using a hacksaw, pickaxe, and a chainsaw.
Jesus.
And then he burned the body and buried it in a shallow grave in the woods.
Okay, that's just a bit of overkill.
For no reason. For no fucking reason.
No reason.
After that, he cleaned up. He took Saturday off, and then he went to work for his normal shift as a line cook at the inn on Sunday, like nothing ever happened.
What?
He went to work where this man lived after brutally murdering and dismembering him, like nothing happened.
All right. All right.
Well, it's not like people didn't know the guy there. They're like, he lived there. He worked there.
Yeah.
People are going to notice that he's gone.
And he never gave a reason for shooting this guy?
No. He gave a reason, but it wasn't a good one.
Okay, I'll wait for the reason.
You can wait for the reason. Okay. Julie noticed that Whitehurst had gone missing, and he'd been missing since Friday, and there are some speculations that she'd started to ask the rest of the staff if he had said anything about going home for the holiday weekend, or, you know, if anybody, like, had seen him and knew where he was, or, like, did he just up and leave? Like, his stuff is still here. I assume he's coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Other people believe that she wasn't at all suspicious, and she literally didn't have the time to be suspicious yet. But she was the next one to die.
Wait, she was?
Yeah.
She wasn't, was she there?
What do you mean?
Okay, so I thought she had moved at this point and was just sort of like running this inn remotely.
No, she was still living in the inn and trying to sell it. Like, she was still running it while she was trying to sell it.
Okay, I'm there now.
But anyway, he came to work on Sunday, and he also shot and killed her and her three dogs.
Oh, how dare he touch those dogs. How dare he?
Right?
A human is one thing, a dog is another.
Right? Well, you can't have the dogs making a fuss and, like, dragging dismembered body parts out to the road where people might see it. So instead of, like, I don't know, leaving the dog in the woods, you kill it, apparently.
Yeah. Not to say that a human life isn't precious. It is precious. But dogs have never done anything to anyone.
Anyway, she was also dismembered, but she was not buried. Instead, she was left in a quote-unquote pile behind the inn with the dogs.
Oh my god.
And things from there, at this point he's killed his coworker and his boss.
Yes.
The boss, at least supposedly, was to cover up the other murder.
Okay.
Well, you remember Selby, sweet little Selby, with two young children who moved out to Maine to get a new life and had just earned her real estate license?
Oh no. No, no. Not Selby.
She had tried to call her mother, and Julie was prone to pretty bad asthma attacks. So when she didn't get in touch over the holiday weekend, and then Selby couldn't reach her by phone, the town that Selby was working in was like 15 minutes away.
Yeah.
So she grabbed a friend from work and decided to go visit Mom.
Oh, no.
She and her friend, Cynthia Beetson, decided to go check on Julie just to make sure that she was okay.
Yeah.
Both women, upon finding the blood trail that led to the back of the inn, were also shot, killed, and dismembered, and left behind the inn in a different place than Julie.
Oh my god. Okay.
He specifically took the fingers off of these two women so that he could take their rings.
But just take that. You don't have to cut the finger off to get the ring off.
I know that. Thank you. I think a lot of people are pretty well aware of that. Didn't change what he did.
Yeah.
So at this point, Nielsen has four dead bodies and three dogs. And he's getting a little overwhelmed with all of this, so he decides to call in what he thinks are going to be reinforcements. He calls his father and his stepmother, who get there, see the blood trail, and immediately call the fucking police.
Why? If you're not 100% sure these people would help me murder somebody else, do not call those people. There is no... Okay.
This is the... I guess this is a little bit of the more... This is just a continuation of the weird. I don't understand this man.
There's no 1-800 serial killer helpline. Like, once you've gone down that path, you are a loner down that path.
Mm-hmm.
Also, poor baby being overwhelmed by all of the bodies in his backyard.
Seriously. All right, so his stepmother immediately calls the police, and she's like, yeah. Are you okay? I'm gonna call the police.
Also, can I just say that for my child, I might hesitate a second before calling the police. If it's my stepchild, fuck you. I didn't give birth to you. I'm calling the police immediately.
Apparently, she agrees with you.
Yes.
So, at about 5:30 p.m. on September 4th, so Monday. This started on Friday. This is now Monday.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Trooper Dan Hansen from the Maine State Police received a dispatch telling him that there had been a report of an unattended death at the Black Bear Inn.
Oh, this he had man no idea.
Did not know what the fuck he was getting into.
He went like right before lunch. He was like, it doesn't look like it. It was just, we'll stop at Dunkin' Donuts on our way home. Oh, that's a stereotype, but everyone likes Dunkin' Donuts.
Seriously, though. When he arrived at the inn, he was greeted by Nielsen's stepmother, who told him that her husband had just found some bodies behind the inn, and that her stepson had been the one to kill these people.
Okay, lead with my stepson inside, shot and dismembered a couple of people. Not, oh hey, my husband found some dead bodies, and I think my stepson might have killed them.
No, it's... we found bodies. My stepson killed them.
Okay.
I think with about that urgency.
Yeah.
When Trooper Hansen approached Nielsen, he was calmly sitting on a bench outside of the inn. Just chilling the fuck out. Nothing to be worried about.
Okay. Whatever anxiety drugs he's on, I need them.
Right? When he was asked what happened, Nielsen responded with, "Well, I killed some people, Dan. The gun's in the house and the tool chest."
This is not the Andy Griffith Show. You are not on a first name basis with the officer that's about to arrest you.
Fucking nonsensical shit. Like, I'm just reading through this and I'm like, someone wrote this and didn't do a good job. This is like sixth grade fan fiction of how a murder would go. Are you shitting me?
Well, Dan, I murdered those people.
Well, Dan, I killed some people. Do you guns want some in the coffee? House, it's in the tool chest. By the way, it's in the tool chest. He murdered the fucking handyman first. He kept the gun in the fucking tool chest.
Oh my God.
Sorry.
No, that's a great detail. Oh, that reminds me of a detail for my story.
Ooh.
Beasley took the gun he shot those people with to a gun repair shop and had it cleaned and repaired.
You're fucking with me. No, he did not.
He did.
What?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I just remembered that.
Anyway, Trooper Hansen followed the literal blood trail to the back of the inn and found Selby and Cynthia's bodies. And he wandered right back out to the front of the inn and went, "Okay, you're under arrest. Let me read you your Miranda rights."
Yeah.
And he placed them in the back of a police cruiser and was just like, "I need more people here."
I need it to not just be me and the mass killer.
So he
and
calls
the
in,
mass killer's family.
Yeah, so he calls in a couple of other people. But while he's waiting, Nielsen's been Mirandized, and Hansen asks Nielsen...
Before you go on,
yeah,
does he call in other people, like the stepmom called him and is like, hey, there's some dead bodies. I think I might have the guy.
I hope so. Anyway, Hansen asked Nielsen if he would like to explain what happened. Do you want to talk to me? You don't have to talk to me, but do you want to?
Yeah.
And Nielsen responded, yeah, but I only want to say it once.
Efficiency.
So at this point, Nielsen's dad comes running up to the car and is like, maybe you should wait for a lawyer. Like, don't talk to them. And Nielsen's like, yeah, that's probably a good idea. I'm still going to tell him everything, though.
Oh, my God.
Okay. Don't do that.
No. Oh, man.
Don't do that shit. Okay, anyway.
No, him and the last guy that you talked about, worst clients a defense attorney could ever ask for.
A little bit. From what I can tell, there was never a trigger that set off these events. There was never a fight between Nielsen and Whitehurst. There wasn't a fight between Nielsen and either of the mother or daughter. There were some suspicions early on that there was a conspiracy between Julie and Whitehurst to evict Nielsen because he hadn't been paying his share of rent, but that never panned out.
Okay. So he just sort of showed up to work one day and went, I'm gonna kill this guy.
The motive that Nielsen offered was that he had, for at least 5 years, been fixated on becoming a serial killer.
Oh, no. You know, I've read so many stories where it's like these, and they're always like kids or just like young adults or like kids that are just like, what's it gonna be like to murder somebody? There's actually, oh man, I can't remember if it's a book or a movie, but it's a show on Netflix. I'll have to tell you the show name later, but it's like this kid who's fixated on killing somebody and he runs away with like this girl and realizes that he's actually not a serial killer.
No, I know what show you're talking about though.
Yeah. It's a really good show.
Oh, was it? I never watched it. I just...
Oh, it was actually really good.
Oh, good. Okay. Anyway, he had for at least 5 years been fixated on becoming a serial killer. And even though he fully understood what he was doing and he knew that it was wrong, he murdered and dismembered these four people without any thoughts of remorse.
Oh, my God.
He killed Whitehurst because he wanted to, and he killed Beetson and the Bullards to cover his tracks.
Oh, my God.
That's it. Oh. That's as deep as this goes. It is so shallow.
A despicable human being.
Yep.
I'm looking up that show now. Continue. Sorry.
Fine. He was, by all accounts, he gave his confession once at the police station, and from that point on, he was completely uncooperative with police and with his attorneys. He refused to discuss a further motive with anybody, and he spent the entirety of his first court appearance smirking.
Oh my God. Ew.
Right?
No.
He was put through...
Oh, by the way, The show is called End of the Fucking World. It's a really good show if you want to watch it.
Nice. He was put through really rigorous psychological testing, and he was diagnosed with schizoid personality disorder and possibly, quote, other mental health problems.
I think, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Think there's something else other than schizoid personality disorder.
Right. Like, that's a bad one. Don't get me wrong. That's not an easy thing to live with. But I have a feeling there's probably other things, too.
There's definitely other things. He also watched way too much of the Andy Griffith Show.
Yeah, he did. He absolutely refused to take an insanity plea, to offer his diagnosis as a reason for the crime, or to expand on a motive beyond, I wanted to. This was absolutely in the face of his attorney's recommendations, and he eventually did plead guilty to all charges against him because he didn't want to go to trial. He either wanted to be declared incompetent or take a guilty plea.
And so he took it because to be declared incompetent would take away what he had done. He was like basking in this glory that he accomplished his goals. And if he's declared incompetent, oh, well, maybe you're just crazy instead of a serial killer.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So he pled guilty. He has been sentenced to 4 consecutive life sentences.
Yes.
Which is as much of a fuck you as the justice system in Maine can give you.
Can give you, yeah.
He has thus far shown absolutely no remorse for what he's done, according to the prosecuting attorneys.
What a piece of shit.
So, anyway, in the aftermath of this, Brooke Bullard, who was Selby's sister, read a statement that was written by Selby's now 10-year-old son, Elliot, who is back living in California.
Okay, I was about to say, what happened to the kid?
At least the son, the young one, is back living in California. I didn't find what happened to the daughter, but I assume they stayed together.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it would be cruel to separate them at this point.
Right? Like, you lost your father in a car accident. You lost your mother and your grandmother to a deranged fucking murderer. Like, at least let you keep your sibling until something else horrible happens to your family.
Oh my god. Yeah. We don't wish something else horrible happen, but yeah.
No, but like, I don't see good things on this kid's horizon with that sort of a backstory.
This is a gypsy curse if I've ever seen one.
Yeah. All right, here, ready for your heart to break a little bit?
Oh, no. I already cried today at Nick and Tanya. Okay, go for it.
In the statement, which Elliot titled, "How My Life Changed and I Was Forever Wounded," he said that couldn't understand the violence that took his mother and grandmother's lives. Quote, "They've all walked the stairway to heaven. At least there's no violence up there."
Oh, no. I don't know why, but I'm super emotional recently, and I've been crying at the drop of a hat.
Right? Well, I don't know if you noticed, but your entire life has changed within the last month. I don't know. Maybe that's a reason to cry over things.
That's true. I was literally, like, I found a comic on, I don't remember if it was Tapas or Webtoon, but it was just this girl who had gone through, like, trauma in her life and was, like, trying to make it better. And I read the whole thing in, like, a night and was, like heavy sobbing.
Oh, speaking of good comics on Tapas and Webtoons, I have been reading Gwendy and Ghost by Sierra Jackson. Okay. Oh, it's
and
good.
I sent you what was it, Slackworm?
Yeah, I love it. It's so good. I have never really identified with like a dragon before.
Oh my god, it's the best comic ever.
It's so good. Okay, anyway. That was my story. My sources are from the Sun Journal, the New York Times, NBC News, findlaw.com. I found the actual court documents.
Ooh.
And Murderpedia.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That was, like, I'm so mad that, like, there was just no reason other than, like, I just decided to be a serial killer.
There wasn't any. And, like, whenever I do all of these, I'm like, well, what the, what happened? Like, I'm super interested in, like, what happened to you along the way? Like, what brought you to this point? And it's never a satisfying end, literally, when somebody says, I felt like it.
I just wanted to.
It's like the first episode that we did with Skylar Niece.
Yes.
It's like, well, we didn't like her anymore, so we just murdered her. It's fine.
Oh my god. People like that are like, I mean, they're worse than the scum of the earth.
Yeah, seriously.
Ugh.
It's just, it's not understandable to me. And I think that's part of what gets me so interested. Because, like, I want... If there's one thing, like, one common thread of what I've studied forever, there's not a reason. And, like, if there's any sort of common thread between, like, what I've been interested in or what I've studied, it's, like, trying to figure out why people do what they do, whether it's through school or through this podcast or through, like, what I'm interested in generally. I want to understand people. And this is something that I will never get. And so, like, I want it more.
Yes, exactly. Well, I mean, you have empathy and sympathy, and you aren't a horrible human being. So, like,
oh, thank you.
You're welcome. So there's, like, no way to, like, even contemplate why, when the only reason why is, I just wanted to kill somebody. Like, that blows my mind.
It really does. And it's so, ugh. Oh, I hate people. Gosh. Sometimes I really hate people, and I think that this is kind of it.
Most of the time, I really hate people.
But anyway, that's my story. That's Christian C. Nielsen, the murderer.
Ugh.
Not Dennis Nielsen.
Yes, I know about Dennis Nielsen. I think he was Scottish. He was living in England. He was Scottish, and he kept... That was, like, the one guy from last podcast on the left that I listened to that I was like, he burned the bodies in sight of his neighbors, and nobody thought about it, because he burned them on, like, a tire fire. And so people were like, ah, that's a horrible smell coming from those tires.
Yeah. No, exactly. That's exactly who I'm talking about. So, like, he mm-hmm. came up in my searches for this. It's, like, I try to find more obscure cases that, yeah. like, I don't want to listen to the 70 billionth person's take on JonBenet Ramsey, you know?
Oh, my God, right?
And, like, I understand.
I love talking about JonBenet Ramsey, though, because her brother did it. I'm telling ya.
No, it was somebody in her family, probably.
No, it was definitely her brother. Did you see the interview that he gave, like, later on in his life to, like, tell people that he didn't do it? He was so creepy.
No, I didn't see it, because I...
you have to look
My
up.
Mom went to school with JonBenet Ramsey's mom. So, like, yeah.
What?
My mom... I have a connection to JonBenet Ramsey because, like, our moms knew each other.
Oh, my God. You're my soulmate.
So that was weird. Also to Mary Lou Retton. But, you know, whatever. Everybody in West Virginia is connected to her in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah. Oh, let's go back to how your mother knows JonBenet Ramsey's mother.
That's all I know about it. That was the beginning, middle, and end of that story. I don't think they were, like, childhood besties or whatever.
You know, my aunt went to school with Jennifer Garner.
Really? That's interesting. Uh-huh.
She was, I think she was like either a year or 2 years ahead of her.
Well.
She was actually, my aunt was friends with Jennifer Garner's sister.
Oh, nifty.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
The people you meet in high school, man.
Right? We're rambling.
Yeah. We got sidetracked.
We did. So anyway, that's my story. Those are my sources. Thank you all so much for joining us. I really hope that you
absolutely
look around at the other podcasts on our network. They're fantastic people, and we're just going to get better from here. Like, we have a team now. We have a family now that we can learn from, that have been doing this successfully for way longer than we even thought about it.
Exactly. And we also have time now to put more effort into this podcast. Like I said, I have time to, like, put effort into my notes, and I have time to do the research. So hopefully we get better from here on.
Exactly. I hope that you really like this episode. If you have any feedback for us, please feel free to email us at whatsinyourhometown@gmail.com. If you have any stories that you want to write in and you want us to cover, or you have any, like, fun anecdotes that you just want to share, mm-hmm. we're always super excited to hear from you. We got, like, a really, really awesome piece of fan mail that we're going to share in an upcoming episode as soon as we get back to the mm-hmm. person that sent it, just to make sure, like, I want to know what I can share from this. And I don't want to step on anybody's toes, but we so appreciate that email. It made our days.
I opened it and, like, screamed. I was like, oh my God. It's our first piece of fan mail. And I immediately texted Julia. I was like, we have fan mail. You need to read it right now.
It was so good. Anyway, if you're looking around for us, you can follow us on Twitter at WIYHT, on Instagram at What's In Your Hometown. We're trying to get a Facebook page up and running, and you can also follow our network at Civilized Creatures on Twitter and Instagram. So,
and I guess all that leaves is, with all the fucked up shit in the world, you have got to wonder,
what's in your hometown?